We round out the final death throes of the Amalgam Universe. Episode 186 of The Byword begins now. Welcome into the Nerd Byword, the only podcast that can jump between universes and not bat an eyelash. We are here for episode 186, Unlimited Access. And we have an additional story that we missed on our previous collection, so stick around for that as well. But first, it is of course time for... Nerd News! Dave, what do you have for us this week?
Well, great sadness, it turns out, as there's a rumbling at one of the studios that is responsible for some Life is Strange games. It turns out that there was a massive IGN report that was recently published, and I know it's always fun when a video game outlet actually tries to do some serious journalism. Always makes me happy. And in this massive IGN report, they kind of dove into... Deck 9 Games, which is a studio that made some of the, let's say, not mainline necessarily Life is Strange games. The mainline Life is Strange games are done by Dontnod. But Deck 9 was responsible for the prequel Before the Storm, as well as Life is Strange True Colors. And there's all sorts of very juicy, very troubling stuff that came out of this report about the developer. Not the least of which is apparently that Square Enix, the publisher of the Life is Strange series, was very hands-on with the script, particularly because the main character in True Colors is very clearly a bi character, and Square Enix was troubled by this and kept repeatedly saying that they didn't want Life is Strange to be that gay game. Which, you know, what am I even supposed to say to that? It turns out, actually, that Life is Strange True Colors was, very well received, apparently, and got a lot of accolades for the way it handled that particular element of the story. And then, of course, at that point, once they got some acclaim for it, Square Enix finally backed off. But that is really just sort of the tip of the iceberg of this report. There has been, reports now of massive crunch in the development of these games at Deck 9. Every woman that IGN spoke to for their story had at least one story of being subjected to some kind of harassment within the company. Then, of course, you have CCO Zach Garris, who's accused in this report of forming inappropriate relationships with women at the company and calling the Black Lives Matter movement a hate movement. He also once apparently, according to the report, said members of the team were getting hung up on political ideologies and then proceeded to ask all staff in the meeting to list their political affiliations. apparently there's like some really troubling stuff going on behind the scenes of this developer, which is, you know, incredibly sad because, you know, both Before the Storm and True Colors feature, queer relationships and both are incredibly well executed. So somebody at that studio knew what they were doing. And the fact that, there's such a toxic environment then at Deck 9, and on top of that, Square Enix was basically against that element of the story is incredibly troubling. Now, Garris, had his own quote there in that IGN article to kind of, deflect, I guess. According to him, and this is the quote, if you are looking for clarity around the views of Deck 9, the studio and its leadership, myself included, look to the content the team created as a reflection of the intentions and beliefs of that team. No game is perfect and no production is ever easy. Before the Storm and True Colors were very difficult, but earnest hearts working tirelessly for years prevailed in the production of those games, and I'm proud of what the team produced, grateful for the chance to have been part of it and honored to have touched the lives we have with the content we created. Please do not let the biased view viewpoint of a select few blind you to the truth as a whole. Now, I have not personally played True Colors yet, although it is on my list of games I still want to play. I did play Before the Storm, as it is a prequel to the original Life is Strange game, which I have repeatedly talked about how much I enjoyed that game. And Before the Storm was very, very good as well, and definitely in line with the original. So if, you know, the product very clearly is, you know, is very inclusive and open and incredibly well executed. And it's incredibly sad then that the behind the scenes does not reflect apparently what the product was. Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
This is wild. This is completely new to me. This completely was off of my radar. I mean, I'm doing a quick Google search to kind of acclimate myself to this story in preparation for the episode, and I'm seeing hidden Nazi symbols being the tip of the toxic iceberg coming from IGN. So this is wild, and unfortunately it's just more of the same when it comes to corporate America, it seems. And you have things like this with what we went through with Activision Blizzard, and the gaming industry is not immune from the same kind of pitfalls of awful behavior that continues to be swept under the rug, it seems.
Yeah. It's always, you know, incredibly sad when you see something like that, specifically from developers that created something that, you know, you really connected with. And so as a gamer who really enjoyed Before the Storm in particular, this really bugs me, man. It really does. All right, you bring some positive news, I guess. This is definitely an interesting situation, considering that once again, social media is a toxic cesspool in response to a casting announcement. I can't wait to talk about this.
Not footage, not an actual film being released, but just a casting announcement. So we have a Silver Surfer casting announcement in Julia Garner. So it will indeed be a female iteration of the character, but it will be Shalla Ball, and I am not very well versed in the Fantastic Four universe, certainly not in the Silver Surfer universe. But the character was created by Stan Lee and John Buscema in 1968 Silver Surfer number one. Initially established as the Empress of Planet Zenla, is also a love interest of Norrin Rad, who most casual consumers know as the Silver Surfer. So interested to see where they go in this direction. I'm still taking a very much a wait and see approach on this Fantastic Four film. The casting was kind of hit and miss for me. We talked about that a good deal before, but intriguing at the very least to see how they go with the direction of this film.
Yeah, I have absolutely no problem with this. I'm not, as you pointed out yourself, neck deep in the Silver Surfer lore or anything. But you know, it's pretty clear, right, that that this is a pre-existing character, right? And so this whole like, oh no, they're gender flipping a character or something is very, very silly. You know, once again, there's always this you know, knee-jerk reactionary stuff that ultimately happens with these sorts of casting announcements. When they try to do something that might be not 100% faithful. And look, there are things that I want 100% faithful, you know, as well. You know, like when it comes to my Superman, I want Superman to be Superman, which is one of my big problems with Man of Steel. But there are also things that I think are a little more changeable, malleable, right? And I don't think the Silver Surfer, although he has his fans, in the context of a Fantastic Four movie, it is absolutely essential for the Silver Surfer to be Norrin Rad, right? And so to explore a different character, a different pre-existing character in the role of Silver Surfer, or maybe there being two Silver Surfers and they both, you know, are heralds, yeah, of Galactus, or whatever they end up doing is at least worth of giving an honest to goodness chance, I would say, right? Yeah, it's kind of hard telling where they're going to go with this ultimately, but I think one of the things we have to accept about the MCU is that any time that the MCU touches something that has previously been adopted, you are probably not going to see it exactly the same way you've previously seen it, right? The last Fantastic Four movies did in fact do a very traditional sort of Silver Surfer. And so it's not surprising that they're going to try to do it a little differently here to differentiate what they're creating. Just the same way as the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies did not go back to the well of the same kind of origin story, the whole Uncle Ben thing. We had seen it twice at that point already, right? And so they went in a little bit of a different direction to differentiate the MCU version of the character from what had come before. And I think it's absolutely fair to assume that very similar things are going to end up happening with the X-Men, right? We're not going to see something that's going to look like the Fox X-Men movies once the MCU introduces those characters. They are going to go in a different direction because they want to differentiate from what came before. This is going to be their own take. Now, whether that is a good thing or a bad thing necessarily, that they want to be different for difference's sake, that's an interesting debate perhaps. But this is it's very telegraphed. That's what they're wanting to do. You saw it very clearly with their approach to Spider-Man, that they want to be different from previous adaptations. And so that, I think, falls right in line with what they're trying to do.
And I think that's my preference, because if you want a copy and paste page to screen adaptation, I think that's boring. And I think it's like it becomes like a karaoke performance, because the source material is not going anywhere. If you still find that as your preference, then go back and read those books. I like switching up it a little bit. I should mention that Julia Garner won 3 Emmy Awards for the show Ozark, as well as a Golden Globe for Inventing Anna. Those are two programs that I've never seen. So this is a pretty big swing and a pretty big get for the MCU.
Yeah, and I don't think we can fault the casting, right? Just as far as like quality of actor goes. So the fact that once again we're all, you know, hung up on the gender of what's going to be essentially a supporting character in a larger story is, you know, it is what it is. I'm not surprised at this point anymore.
All right, that wraps up nerd news for this week. When we come back, we are going to put the finishing touches on the Amalgam Universe. Welcome back to the main segment of our program today. We call it our byword. The Big Talk. And we're going to color outside the lines a little bit. In the previous episodes where we talked about the amalgam slates of comics, there was one that was left off the lists that we had, and so we wanted to remedy that situation. First and foremost, we're looking at Iron Lantern, which was by Kurt Busiek and Paul Smith. You'd be hard-pressed to find a better creative team than that one. Dave, what were your thoughts on Iron Lantern?
So I'll take back what I said last week when I proclaimed that the Superboy team-up book was the best of this batch. I mean, the Spider-Boy team-up book was the best of this batch. This is the best of the batch. And I think we would have had a lot less of a sour taste in our mouth last week if we would have actually read this issue with that batch, because this was quite fantastic. I really liked it from start to finish. What an interesting amalgamation, and how seamless it works to put Iron Man and Green Lantern together. They made that work seamlessly. Pepper Potts and Carol Ferris came together as a really interesting character. I just think this one worked. I think they did Rhodes and John Stewart, right? Were together. Were amalgamated. You know, the final reveal was a little cheesy, obviously, right? Because some amalgamations you just have to come up with a better name for. Because putting the Mandarin and Sinestro together, what did they end up going with? The Sinestarian or something? Like, it was, I couldn't...
Mandarinestro.
Mandarinestro.
The name was goofy, but I rode with it, I thought it was a nice amalgamation.
The design was really good, right? And the design of merging together at the beginning of the book, Hector Hammonds and MODOK was actually really good, right?
Oh God, that was fun.
Yeah. And you know, Hal Jordan as a character has always been a little bit of a cocky, you know, son of a gun. So putting him with Iron Man, that really, really shines through, I think. I also thought it was a really interesting twist that the Kyle character here the substitute Iron Lantern is actually more like a bad guy here, right? That he's actually like power hungry and wants the power for himself again, right? He doesn't just want to be a substitute. He wants to be the main guy and actually goes and, you know, steals the power source. Just a really, really fun stuff here. The art was really good. The writing, man, it's Kurt Busiek. What? How can you go wrong with Kurt Busiek? Kurt always understands the assignment. Let's put it that way. Like this is quintessential Amalgam. This is like top tier. This is what the Amalgam universe is all about. Like, it just works on every single level, from the characters, the way they were amalgamated, to the story, to the art. Like, the whole thing just clicks. I really, really love this. Best of the Marvel batch season 2, I'd say.
And not to put the cart before the horse, I think this ultimately gets something right. What the series we're going to talk about in a minute gets right is it's a fresh change of pace. It has a clear story arc. You can see, like, this is classic comics at its best. Like, from one panel to the next, there's a clear story being told. As you said, the amalgamations were completely seamless. It's a real kind of love letter to, like, the golden age of comics. Like, you've got, like, the, oh gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name that they based, like, Tony Stark on, like the tiny little mustache.
Howard Hughes,
thank you. Some, like, a very Howard Hughes vibe to this, which Stan Lee, you know, whether he's telling a tall tale or not, is someone who said that he based Iron Man on. But it's such a fun story. Like I said, everything is amalgamated so well. The Madame Sapphire angle is fascinating to me. I'm not sure, like, of the origins of that.
I don't know the Madam part. It's Star Sapphire on the DC side, but I have no idea what came in on the Marvel side.
Probably be Madam Mask, who shows up typically with, like, the street level crime, like the Magia crime family. And then you have, like, the Great White, who's like King Shark, but like an android. So
yeah, some kind of robot thing, right?
Yeah. But yeah, this was a really fun book, and I highly recommend it. This was probably my favorite amalgamation that we've ever read, maybe up there with, like, Dark Claw, this most recent Dark Claw.
Yes, and it's really interesting to me too how, you know, a lot of the books that we looked at amalgamated characters for amalgamation's sake, but then didn't do anything with them. But here, every character serves a purpose, right? Every amalgamation that you run into in this book is there for a reason. There's not an ounce of waste on this comic. It just actually works. They managed to stuff all those references and all those amalgamations in there, but it all actually serves a purpose. And I think a lot of the Amalgam books we've looked at have been very meandering, right? Like, they just don't quite know what they're saying. Here is a character we amalgamated, but we're not doing anything with. I'm looking at you, Dr. Doomsday, for example. I wanted so much more from that character and got nothing, right? So I think this is the quintessential Amalgam book. Like, this, if they ever decide to do another round of Amalgam stories, this should be the template. This is how it's done right.
And as an X-Men fan, like, anytime you see Paul Smith, you know everybody's going to look gorgeous. Like, so the art is fantastic. I think if I had one critique of this story is I'm pissed that it's over and I want to read more. I want Mandarin Estro.
Yeah, I would love to see more. I really would. Yeah. The next issue was supposed to be called, "Oh, Bring Back My Lantern to Me." What a great tease for the next issue. I really would have loved to read more. Yeah.
All right, so that was a fun little romp, but we are headed now into the main reason for coming together today, and it is to look at Unlimited Access, which was written by Carl Kessel with art by Pat Oliff. And so this is our traditional, when we have one series that we look at that is continuous. With the previous couple of collections, we had one shot, so we just kind of riffed like we did with the previous one. But when we have a cohesive series, whether it's television, video games, a film, or in this case a miniseries, we like to give the likes, the dislikes, and then a final verdict after that, because we like everything perfectly balanced as all things should be. So Dave, the first like that you have for Unlimited Access.
So I first want to say that my initial reaction when I looked at the cover of issue one was, oh crap, this isn't Ron Mars. Like, you know, Ron Mars was neck deep in writing DC versus Marvel, and also was the writer of All Access, the previous miniseries. And I was like, oh crap, I wonder what happened here. Should I be worried? Because, you know, generally I like Mars a lot. The guy can cook, you know? But I have to say, the very first thing after the first issue was like, holy crap, there's a lot happening here. And it just never let up. This series is so stuffed with characters. There are so many different crossovers, meetings between characters, misunderstandings and fights. Sure, yeah, that too. But just like the scope of this story is really like almost unhinged. When you look at the previous series, All Access, you got like basically one major sort of crossover per issue, right? So you had like the first issue was Superman, Spider-Man. The second issue was Robin and Jubilee. The third issue was Batman and Doctor Strange. And the fourth issue was basically like X-Men, JLA, right? But this book just doesn't let up. It starts with sort of this one-off traditional crossover thing when it's Wonder Woman and Spider-Man, which, by the way, how much fun was it when Wonder Woman said, you want my lasso, why don't you wrestle me for it? And Spidey got all flustered.
Oh my god. Peter Parker? I don't know. If there's a gentleman named Peter Parker, his wife is looking for him.
That was priceless. But yeah, then it just dovetails, and suddenly we get all these different characters. I mean, this series does not avoid or a single possibility for introducing any kind of character and having characters meet. This really feels like the perfect sort of swan song in a way, because it didn't leave anything on the table. It ate the whole buffet, and I loved it for it. All these characters showing up were so interesting and so well executed. Loved it.
Yeah, walk with me here, Dave. What I found interesting about this series is not only was it an amalgamation of characters, it was an amalgamation of comic book storylines. Not only are you jumping back and forth between two different universes, you're also adding the aspect of time travel into it. So I thought that was a fascinating thing to introduce here. I kind of have my eye roll built in when it comes to time traveling stories, but I think this was executed pretty well, considering such an ambitious thing. But like I said before, with Iron Lantern, this had a clear objective. It was really ambitious, and for the most part, it fired on all cylinders really, really well.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Now, looking at your likes, and I'll talk more about the time travel thing here in a second, but I really like your first point, because I think it's an absolute valid criticism of, like, the previous Access series.
Yeah, well, I like your buffet analogy, because the previous ones kind of felt like, we will serve you this food item now, then you will get this food item next. Like, here are two characters, then there aren't. It was very kind of rigid storytelling, very episodic, which can work, but it didn't in that context for me particularly. It didn't really make Axel stand out. He was a benevolent bystander, I think I called him. But I think this story around this time around, it was a much more cohesive story. It was like going to a buffet. Like, I want mashed potatoes and I want pizza. So like it kind of mashed up a good some good things, and it was like a very clear kind of through line at the same time.
Yeah, it's definitely more cohesive. I think the previous series was very episodic in nature, even though it tried to kind of tell an overall story. I think it was very episodic, and this one does not feel episodic. It feels very much like a complete story from start to finish, and I really liked it for that.
All right, Dave, I kind of stole your thunder a little bit, but open up about your second like.
Yeah, so time travel is difficult to execute well, right? But I think this series really got it right. And one of the things that it really got right here is it understood the history of characters at both companies, if that makes sense, right? So you get meetings here that are way beyond interesting if you have any kind of investment in the DC or the Marvel universe, and you really get some bang for your buck if you're invested in both. So can we have the current Justice League and the current Avengers meet? Sure, but it's a very different animal if you have the very first Justice League and the very first Avengers meeting, right? And so it really leans into the possibilities, not just of characters from different eras like Two-Gun Kid and Jonah Hex, but also leans into the notion of plucking heroes from different points in their timeline, right? So the Wonder Woman we meet at the start, for example, is earlier in her career. The Justice League that we meet is like the Justice League Year One, which was, I think, Mark Waid's story, right? A Justice League without Superman, right? But then we get Superman from his Electric Blue era when Superman is brought in. We get Young Justice characters like Superboy, Robin, and Wonder Girl, but you get them before they formed Young Justice, right? So that's a very specific snapshot in their careers. You get multiple versions of X-Men, right? I mean, you get like, what is it, the Days of Future Past X-Men, and you get the sort of first class X-Men, right? So I think there's something very cool about how the series understands the history of the characters and then plucks characters from a particular moment within their histories to then meet with other characters, right? It sounds really convoluted, but when you're really invested in these universes, seeing, you know, Mark Waid's JLA Year One meeting the very first Avengers team, it's a very different beast than having a modern Avengers team and, let's say, Grant Morrison's JLA meeting, right? So this is very, very knowledgeable, I guess, is the best way to put it, about the history of both comic book companies. And because of that, I think the time travel really, really works. I also think it's very interesting how they ended up coming around to the whole bum character from DC versus Marvel, and basically, kind of creating a loop where he reveals that he's actually, you know, Axel in the future, right? So that it's sort of a perfect loop, which means Axel has basically already seen himself die, which is kind of messed up, and he actually struggles with that.
Make of that what you will. Yeah,
so he actually struggles with that. There's some interesting stuff that comes out of that. So I think the time travel stuff could have been just an afterthought that was thrown in here to go to places like the Old West and see people like Jonah Hex. But instead, there's a real deep knowledge of the history of these characters within each universe, and then plucking them from specific places within their timelines to create really interesting character interactions. I think that's super cool, Chris.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it was a real love letter to like the history of comic books up until that point. And I believe we're in 1997, publication wise. And so it's clearly a creative team that loves the medium, that has love for both companies, for both lines. And then kind of just traveling back and forth. It almost felt like a history lesson in those. There was almost like a certain breaking of the fourth wall element to it by going the route that they did. And I think it was extremely beneficial to my level of investment when it came to reading it. It was also cool. Like it was like self-referential as well. And you get this with Star Trek sometimes, but you mentioned this, the Two-Gun Kid. And he talks about the Avengers. He's like, oh, I know the Avengers. I met them once. And it references like a specific Avengers issue where he crossed over into the future and worked with them. So that was incredibly, incredibly fun.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So what was your second like of Unlimited Access?
I think some of the handling of it was a little bit wonky, but I like the idea that the villains had a falling out. We always see hero versus hero because of a misunderstanding or whatever, shenanigans. But having the villains have a disagreement that escalates to the point of fighting each other I think that was a much more realistic, like, these people have very strong feelings about what they want the world to be. So it only makes sense that those ideologies would clash. So I really enjoyed the villains kind of duking it out.
You know, I tend to agree. It's oftentimes sort of a wasted opportunity. We always have like hero versus hero beating the snot out of each other first in crossovers like this, and the villains team up very quickly, you know what I mean? And then the heroes have to overcome their differences in order to take down a unified, you know, villain force. But here, that they were actually at each other's throats, I really like that. It's something that in crossovers oftentimes gets a bit overlooked, I think, is the best way to put it.
Dave, it only took us umpteen series, but we finally have something here with your final like.
Oh, yeah. Axel is a person in this book and not a MacGuffin. Like, Kessel actually comes in and says, okay, I'm gonna treat this like an actual character. I'm going to give Axel an arc. I'm going to give him obstacles. And rather than just being like a point of view character or a MacGuffin to get people from one universe to the other, he really goes through it in this story, right? From realizing, you know, that he's seen his own future before and he already knows how he's going to die, to trying to figure out how this time travel works and basically getting lost in time. To facing off with Darkseid and basically, you know, trying to deal with the possibility that he could actually go bad, you know, and serve Darkseid. Like, there's actually some interesting stuff happening here with Axel. Now, the girlfriend thing, we'll talk about that later. But as a character, I think Axel here feels for the first time like an actual character. And it kind of made me sad when I reached the end of the story and I realized that this is literally his last appearance, because now that he actually is a fully formed character that I'm actually getting invested in, now there's nothing more, right? Like, up until now, he was just a MacGuffin. We get this awesome limited series that really creates a character out of this MacGuffin, and now he's just gone, and we've not seen him since. So this is probably the best version of Axel Asher by far.
Yeah, they actually gave him some heart beneath those shoulder pads.
Those shoulder pads. He even makes fun of his own shoulder pads at one point.
Yeah, I thought it was incredibly interesting. I just would have liked more for the ladies in the story. But more on that later.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, that brings us to your final like of the story, Chris. What have you got?
I mean, at the end of the day, Dave, what we want when we read comics is it's a fun time. Like, there are really interesting kind of character beats. You sent me one between Martian Manhunter and Thor that's really fun. Calling him like a little green man, but you're not little. Nay. So, and then you have, character interactions between two universes, and it's not adversarial. Like, we have just kind of conversations between these characters. We have like strategy planning, and even dueling kind of like strategic plans, like, oh, I think we should do this. Oh, we should actually listen to this strategic leader. You've got Captain America and Cyclops in the same room, and that's even within the Marvel universe. You got Superman in the same room. Like, you've got all these tacticians there. Like, something's got to give. So I thought it was a great time and it was fun.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think this is It's like we're ending on a real high note with this episode, but I think Iron Lantern is sort of the best amalgam story that's come out of the whole DC versus Marvel thing, and I think Unlimited Access is probably the most fun, just straight-up crossover story that we got out of this whole collaboration. Does it have its problems? Sure. But, you know, if we ever decide to go back to the well here, DC and Marvel, which, you know, they are reprinting some of this stuff, so maybe there's some consideration for that. I think this is the template if they want to do an Access story again. This is much closer to what the earlier appearances probably should have been. This was a really fun time.
Yeah, and it was a pleasant surprise. Like, kind of peek behind the curtain, we're recording this on WrestleMania Sunday. So last night I was occupied till like 11:30, and so I was like, oh crap, I still have to read that. And the last slate of issues did not leave the best taste in my mouth. So I was like, oh, here we go. But, you know, actually winding up enjoying these issues was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, it was a good way to end the night, right?
Yeah. All right, now we do have to switch over to the dislikes. We got to get a little bit negative. Dave, which is your first dislike?
Yeah, so when last we left Axis's personal life in shambles, he had broken up with a young woman, Ming, I believe her name was, from the Marvel Universe, and returned to a girl that he saved in the DC Universe, nicknamed Fitz, I believe. And that all goes out the window here. We're back with Ming. He says that he broke up with the other girl. He missed her, and Ming is sort of his destabilizing force in his life. He always wants to come back to her. And that is all cute and stuff, but they then still really don't do anything with Ming as a character, right? And so when it comes full circle at the end and he realizes he can't stay in the Marvel Universe, he has to keep bouncing back and forth because he himself can destabilize things just with his presence, it doesn't really land as powerfully as it could or should, because the person he's leaving behind is really a non-entity as far as being a character, even now, even after all this extra work was done to make Axel an interesting character. They did not put the same effort into making, you know, his significant other here a fully formed character, so that we really feel the pain of him having to basically leave. And I think that was a sad oversight, because they were on to something, right? It kind of made it a tragic love story if we would give a crap about Ming, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so, and Fitz, it gets even worse treatment in this series, because she only gets one Peter Parker-esque floating head of guilt in a panel. It's like, oh yeah, there was a girl Fitz, but that didn't work out, and it's just her superimposed skull, like her cranium just kind of haunting him. But yeah, and so like we're kind of left up in the air, like, is he gonna be a polygamist now, like bounce back and forth and have two girlfriends, one in each universe? Like what are we doing here? So yeah, it was incredibly disappointing to see the treatment of female characters, period, in this, but more on that in a second.
And I think that's probably fair. So let's go ahead and talk about Magneto. I knew you were not going to like what they did with Magneto in this at all. So let's talk about it.
I despise this characterization of Magneto. I get it, because when you're doing the time traveling stuff and you're going back to 60s Magneto, you get mustache twirly, I'm evil overlord Magneto who's super silly and just campy. Like, there is no depth of character. This is not Holocaust survivor Magneto yet. This is not person you relate to on an incredibly close level. There is no depth of character, really. It's just, I'm a bad guy because the plot requires me to be a bad guy, and it's rough. And so as a Magneto super fan, like, it was tough to have to just deal with this for four issues. But yeah, I was not a fan. He looked good, he looked cool, but the characterization was whack.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. It's definitely not my favorite version of Magneto, and you know, I'm, like I said many times before, sort of X-Men agnostic, but I can totally understand why this would rub you the wrong way, Chris.
All right, so we are not one to shy away from dad jokes or puns, so hit me with this next dislike.
Hit you with this next dislike? Yeah, this book is not this book is not accessible. I sang the praises of this book in the likes because of its deep understanding of the characters involved and the histories of those characters, so we can play with this time travel dynamic. But let me tell you, if the reader doesn't have that level of familiarity with both DC and Marvel, this is going to be a big fat nothing burger for them, because it's very difficult sometimes to follow the huge variety of characters and also the huge variety of timelines when you get multiple versions of the same people popping up, right? You know, like, for example, the X-Men from the far future and then from the past. That definitely can give somebody whiplash who is not as deeply familiar with the history of these comic book characters as we might be. So I felt fairly comfortable in this, but I've also been reading comic books for years. So I I know a thing or two about these characters. Like, for example, Electric Blue Superman showing up might not mean a whole lot to the regular readers these days, in this day and time. But, you know, back in the 90s for a while, that was Superman, you know. It's like, that's not Superman. You might react exactly the way Green Lantern did. Like, we met the guy. You're nothing like that guy. So it's not really accessible. It's really for the hardcore DC and Marvel fans.
Yeah, you're definitely going to have a Google tab open if you are a newcomer. Even if it's one side or the other, like if you're a loyal DC reader and you don't really dabble into Marvel or vice versa. Thankfully, throughout the years that we've done this show, I'm well-versed enough, I like to think, in DC, or at least listening to you, Yammer, I have become.
Sorry.
So yeah, I totally agree with you there. This is not new reader friendly by any stretch, but then again, at the same time, at this, when this was written, you're probably looking at 50 years of publication that you're kind of amalgamating and smushing together here.
Yeah, absolutely. And something like this probably wouldn't be horribly reader-friendly these days either. You know, like, it's definitely something for a niche audience of fans of both DC and Marvel.
Definitely time capsule-esque.
Yes, very much so. All right, Chris, this next one is a totally fair thing to say, so say it.
As two white males, this is an incredibly white male focused storyline. Even the few women that do appear, the most that the woman that gives like the most page time and script time is Wonder Woman in that first issue. After that, they are relegated to one-liners only. But it is all white men all the time, except for like the one green guy and the blue guy who's really white. So, yeah, it is. Diversity is not this book's strong suit, and even the white women don't get to talk a whole lot. So it was a bit disappointing. Even like with the amalgamation that we have of, I'm not sure who it was. Was that Shazam Jr. or something? Where
Captain Marvel Jr. Yeah.
Yeah, the wisdom of Eisenhower, the wisdom of Lincoln, or the strategy of Eisenhower, and then this one got me. It was something like the cunning of Nixon. I was like, oh brother, okay.
Oh, that is some cunning there.
So, but really, yeah, it was. It's like I said, it's very much like a time capsule. Like, this is a very 1997 book. Thankfully, we've come a good deal. We still have a long ways to go, but yeah, it was tough sledding.
Yeah, that is totally fair. I think the only female character that gets a really, really strong showing is probably Wonder Woman at the beginning, right? The other female characters feel very, like, you would think, for example, when like all the men on the teams are mesmerized, that the two women would be able to kind of try to sort something out, and then they just start like swinging too. Like, they didn't even really do anything with the fact that the women weren't being brainwashed. So that certainly was a little bit disappointing. Absolutely.
All right, Dave, what is your third and final dislike of this series?
I think it needed more room to breathe. I don't know why they were married to the 4-issue limited series with these. I think this could have easily run 6 issues and given some of these moments a little bit more time to breathe, and us a little bit more time on character interactions. Like, the most fun stuff are the character interactions in this book. And like, you know, Martian Manhunter and Thor that I sent you, I absolutely love that moment. And I wanted more of those kinds of moments. But the plot was just at a breakneck pace the whole time. And because of that, I think that it would have just done much, much better if it was a little longer. I'll also say that I really liked the amalgamations that we got out of this. I thought they were really interestingly done. And I don't think we spent nearly enough time with them, right? And so I just wanted a little bit more time in this whole thing, just to really get to know these characters more and to enjoy them, I guess, a little bit more.
Yeah, and I'll tie in my final dislike here with that, because I think it's an end result of that. This could have easily and should have easily been 2 more issues, because we've seen comics where Like, they, let's say they're on Asteroid M, and there could easily have been two issues that take place while still on Asteroid M. We have had comic book runs where it kind of breathes like that, and you're still on the same mission. So as a result of that, my final dislike is that the ending is just weird and abrupt. Like, you have Darkseid, this unstoppable force that not even Magneto was a match for, just saying, like, you win, Access. You've bested me. Like, what? And then everybody just kind of goes their separate ways. So it was, after this fun romp and adventure, we just kind of awkwardly shuffle off to where we were going in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. It did end really quickly, didn't it? Yeah, I just wanted this thing more, have more time to breathe, man. This is, like I said earlier, despite all the criticisms we have, this is by far the best of these Access stories. And this was the one I just wanted to spend a little bit more time with. So yeah, I agree with that, man.
All right, Dave, let's give a final grade for our final DC versus Marvel / amalgamation. What is your final grade for Unlimited Access?
I really liked Unlimited Access. I think it's, like I said, I think it's the best of this batch of the whole crossover situation. I think it gets the crossovers more right than it doesn't. The introduction of time travel, you know, gives a lot of flexibility for how those crossovers are handled. I just really, really like this one, man. It's so sad to me that this is where we end, right? When this is probably by far the best version of this collaboration. I think if they ever would decide to bring Access back and to do more with this, the template is basically all in this episode. The template for Amalgam is Iron Lantern, and the template for an Access crossover story is Unlimited Access. This is just, we saved the best for last. I was very, very pleasantly surprised, Chris.
Absolutely. I'm going to go like a B+, because like my criticisms, I feel like, definitely put some dings in the armor there, but it was a good time and it was an enjoyable read. So I'm going to go B+. All right, that wraps up our Byword Big Talk. If you are reading along with us, be sure to hit us up on social media at @NerdByWord or @ThatNerdDave, @ThatNerdChris individually with your reactions to the reading. When we come back from our final break, we're going to nerd commend two more things, one each that we enjoyed and we think you would too. Welcome back to the fan favorite segment that we call This is where we recommend stuff that we've been enjoying and we think that you should check out as well. Dave, I am super excited to hear your nerd commendation this week.
We are currently living in a Godzilla renaissance, I would say, right? With the character really being in the zeitgeist right now. First, we had Godzilla Minus One, which we did a major review on. Please go back and listen to that episode. I think you'll really enjoy it. The movie even won an Oscar, right? Which is absolutely mind-boggling that a Godzilla movie won an Oscar. And now we have another Godzilla Kong movie from this side of the pond.
We also have a wonderful Monarch Legacy of Monsters series on Apple TV.
Yes. So there's so much, you know, kaiju-related goodness flying around. People seem to really be latching on to a franchise, which I, you know, grew up loving and always got a lot of side eye for as a kid. You know, like, what, you watch that stuff? So I just want to take a moment today and punt back and just recommend Gojira. I think everybody should go back and watch the original 1954 Godzilla movie. And I'm very clearly saying Gojira here because I think the Japanese version is superior to the 1956 Americanized version when they intercut Raymond Burr into the story to, I guess, make it more palatable for Western audiences or something, whatever. I think the original is far superior.
You know what this story needs? A white man.
Yeah, this story about giant monsters in Japan needs a cracker. I'm telling you, man. I love
Godzilla break this cracker in half.
Now that might actually... No, never mind. Look, what it really comes down to me at least, is simply this. The movie is fantastic, and I think it's much closer in spirit than to something like Godzilla Minus One than it is to what we see, you know, with like... And now King Kong has a giant glove that's made out of metal, you know? It's less an adventurous, smashing your toys together kind of movie, and more something that it really has something to say. And people generally seem to be surprised going back to this movie to see how serious it feels and how devastating it can be on an emotional level, right? I mean, this is really the kaiju movie to start the kaiju movie craze in a lot of ways. But it's not just about a giant monster. It's really... It's kind of melancholy. It really qualifies more as a drama than an action movie, right? Although it has some really cool set pieces. It's a tour de force, really, of practical effects movie making, with the way they used miniatures and puppetry and suit animation to make this thing really work, right? And it really taps into a primal fear that is a natural outgrowth of the mood in Japan in the 1950s as being the country that had two atomic bombs dropped on it, right? It's a spot on allegory for the dangers of nuclear destruction and radiation. It's so smart on so many different levels. Like, the movie has this love triangle, but every one of the characters is like a different side of like this issue of nuclear. You got the intellectual, right, and you got the scientist, and you got the military guy, right? So you got like all these different sides to the issue of nuclear power and nuclear weapons all represented, and then they're in this really human like love triangle thing. Like, this story is just something really, really special. And even though it's old and black and white, you know, I know the current generation is not big into going back to older stuff for some reason. But if you really want to get like this sort of Godzilla Minus One vibe of this really great movie that has something to say about humanity, you've got to go back to the original 1954 Gojira, because it is such a special movie. It still stands as one of my all-time favorite movies, period. And I still frequently watch it. I got the Criterion collection that has the original Japanese version and the Americanized version, both on DVD. And I always go back to the original Japanese version. I turn on those subtitles and I enjoy it, because it's just a fantastic film. So if you're into the current Godzilla craze, if you're feeling of the moment, then spend an hour and a half and go back to where it began. You will not be disappointed. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah, I can't second this nerd commendation enough. I absolutely have fallen head over heels in love with the character of Godzilla, the medium of Godzilla films. And I love that we have kind of the free space to do both. Like, we can mash your toys together with something like Godzilla versus Kong. You can give King Kong an infinity gauntlet. You can, like, still have something as prescient, as important, as Oscar-winning as Godzilla Minus One, and then like a thriller series where you're desperately coming back each week in Monarch Legacy of Monsters. Like, it's just a really good time to be a fan of these characters. But like, I, as a history nerd, as someone who loves going back to the origin point, I truly love the original Gojira. You can watch it for free on Tubi. You can watch it for free on Pluto TV, on those apps, on demand. So no excuses for why you can't enjoy this spectacle of cinema. And to the point where you were saying you wouldn't categorize it as action. If you do a Google search, it lists it as a 1954 sci-fi horror film. And I totally agree with that. Like, yes, it has this beautiful, like, meta contextual message, but like it's very much like a scary movie in the 50s kind of iteration of what that means. And so I love this movie, and I wholeheartedly second this.
Which brings us back to the person writing Avengers as if it's the JLA. I've not actually checked in on this series in a while, so you're nerd commending it. What's going on over there?
You absolutely have to. Jed McKay is entering like the upper echelon of comic book writers, but the likes of Al Ewing and Jonathan Hickman, in my mind, with this series is no disappointment. I loved his work on Black Cat. Now I'm loving his work on Avengers. I loved his Moon Knight stuff previously. I'm even reading his Doctor Strange. I'm reading a Doctor Strange book for the first time ever because of Jed McKay's work. It is just such quality work. There's so many great character moments in this. You have in a medium and in a title like the Avengers that has been around for so long, it can be difficult to be inventive, to be new. But within this first arc, you have new adversaries that are introduced that are incredibly compelling. You have the Impossible City and these characters that are trying to take over the world in different cities. So not only are you globe-trotting and going to different places, you have a character called Idol Alabaster who looks like the biblically accurate description of what an angel. So you have eyeballs all over the place and terrifying wings and all these appendages. And it is, apropos, attacking the Vatican in Rome. So you have a biblically accurate angel attacking the holiest city in the world for Christianity. Like, it's just pitch perfect, like, work, comic book work. Just, it's superheroing. You have great character moments with the cast. I really appreciate this roster. You've got the Black Panther. You've got Captain Marvel, Sam Wilson, Captain America, Thor, Wanda, and Vision. And so it's just a great time. You follow that up with the Twilight Court, which is, a spirit of King Arthur and his court. So that's really interesting. You have the Kang of it all being injected into this. Then you have the most recent issues where they're fighting on behalf of the X-Men who are being persecuted by Orcus. And so it's just a really good time and good cape stuff.
Yeah, I need to check back in with this one, man, because what I read like the first three issues or something, I think, I really, really liked. And I made the comment, and I stand by it, that it felt like a Morrison JLA book almost. Like, this is definitely an Avengers book that's written more like a Justice League book. And so it immediately kind of connected with me. Not that I don't like Avengers books generally, but the vibe of the JLA has always been something really, really special to me. And so I definitely need to come back to this one. Just really, really excited to check this one out.
Well, that wraps another episode of the Nerd Byword. We thank you for rolling along with us for all these episodes, 180 plus. What are we at now? We are 186 episodes. That's crazy. If you would be so kind, if you're finding us for the first time, to be sure to like and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, whether that is Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, or our website, nerdbyword.com.
And find us on social media and let us know what you think of all these different things we've talked about this week. The various news stories, of course, the Amalgam books and Unlimited Access. And our nerd commendations, of course. You can find us pretty much on any social media platform you can think of at Nerd by Word. And individually at That Nerd Dave and at That Nerd Chris.
And as always, stay well and stay nerdy.
The Nerd Byword is written and produced by Chris and Dave, two nerds with a love of all things pop culture. The podcast features music by Al Jimenez, with additional drops composed by Joe Biondi. Our show art is by Ashery Design. Find us at nerdbyword.com and wherever podcasts are available.